Welcome to DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that's thanks to our sponsor this week, New Relic, for making that possible. They are the ones that allow you to get this show for free, and we appreciate it. DLC, of course, is the show all about gaming in its many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard, which we're going to be talking about a lot this week. I am, of course, Jeff Cannata, and I'm joined by my co-host slash buddy, the amazing stand-up comedian and Sony Media enthusiast, Christian Spicer.
Best friend club.
You know why? Because DLC this week means we decide to lose the conceit that I don't like Christian. Because I got a lot of feedback that people didn't like the fact that we were fake enemies.
Well, that's just because, you know, I can do no wrong, and you're just a big meanie pants.
Right. Well, you know, I kind of get it because I remember when I was a kid, I never liked watching Tom and Jerry episodes when they were mad at each other. I always wanted the very few episodes where they were buddies and they were both against the dog. So I get that. People don't like conflict, and they want us to be friends. And we truly are friends in real life.
Yes, and I think the beauty of a show like this is, you know, we can disagree on points, which I'm sure we will. but you know, we're obviously, yeah, we're friends. I mean, I've never met you, and I don't actually think your real name is Jeff. And I've never had you around my child before, but otherwise, I think we're best friends.
There's video evidence to the contrary, sir, but whatever. also, DLC this week means Dice Tower's longtime capo, because we are very pleased to welcome Mr. Dice Tower himself, Tom Vassell, to the show. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. And, you know, I hadn't thought of using that term. Just the other day, I was asked by some business person what my title was. I should have said capo. I think I'm going to start saying that from now on.
I think you should. I think it fits, especially since you are the designer of Nothing Personal, a board game all about mafia capos, right?
Yeah, co-designer. I don't want to leave out my other designer, Steve Avery.
Right. Well, I am completely thrilled to have you on the show. It's something that I've been wanting to do for a long time because I'm a big fan of yours. And the fact that DLC talks about board games and video games as well, we've gotten so much feedback from people saying, talk more about board games. And there is no one on the planet Earth, I think, that knows more about board games or plays more board games than you. And if there are people listening to this that aren't aware of your awesome network, the Dice Tower Network, not only do you do a fantastic podcast and a series of videos and really more shows than I can even list, but you actually are the center of an entire network of shows all about board games in their many forms. So tell people a little bit about that.
Oh, the Dice Tower Network itself, I just basically hunt down other podcasts that meet kind of my same mission, which is to promote board gaming and to do so in a family-friendly setting. And so I thought maybe I'd get one or two, but it appears that we have like 15 or 16 on board at this point in time. And yeah, they really are kind of a wide range all over the board. Like there's one that just joined us who they are talking about people who are playing board games for the very first time. They're not entrenched in a hobby like many people are. So,
right, you know, that's Blue Peg, Pink Peg, right? That's the name of that show?
Actually, no, it's called Start Space.
Oh, Start Space.
Blue Peg, Pink Peg is also similar, but they like are taking a look at it from a married couple's perspective. So that's what I like to have, is as many different voices as possible.
It's great. Go ahead, Christian.
It should be pointed out, though, that while Tom is probably one of the biggest board game experts on Earth, pretty much every astronaut and cosmonaut on the International Space Station is a bigger board game enthusiast.
Right. I mean, they're not on Earth, which is lucky for all of us.
Yeah, they're just orbiting up there and, you know, reenacting gravity over and over and over again and calling dibs on who gets to be Sandra Bullock. It's like, we get it, guys. It was a good movie, but, you know, let's move past it already.
I like how you doubled down on that bit, Christian. That was pro style.
It's commitment. Yeah, I don't back away from bombing.
but Tom, you in 2013, your YouTube channel had 800 plus board game reviews on it?
No, I would like to say 800. We almost hit 800.
Okay.
It was a goal of mine, but we almost hit 100 in January of this year. So I think we'll do it. I think we'll do it in 2014.
That is just insane to me. I mean, I think I play a lot of board games, but you dwarf my gaming output. That is just incredible.
No,
so anyway, I'm really glad to have you here. We're going to talk. It's going to be a board gaming centric episode. Of course, people, this is a call-in show as well, so you're welcome to call in and contribute. You can disagree, like, or comment on the show by calling 512-518-5714. If you're listening to this later and downloaded it at 5by5.tv/DLC, then please try to join us. We record every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. So that's when you can listen live at 5by5.tv/live and call in at 512-518-5714. We'll be getting to some calls very soon. But we always start the show with the story of the week. That's when we convince each other of what the most important story of the week is. So let's hit the theme music, such as it is. Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Yeah, I'm pretty proud of that. Tom is already regretting his choice of being on our show.
I wouldn't know if that was live or not.
No, sadly, that is a recorded bit that we that we pitched to. Oh, it's so it tickles me. Also, you know, if anybody any audience wants to submit a story of the week, you can do so by tweeting at me at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T and using hashtag DLCSOTW, DLC story of the week. You can submit stories of the week in future episodes throughout the week. We'll be checking that. But Tom, I'm wondering if there's any big story that you're interested in this week, particularly.
There's no huge story. There was, I guess the biggest story is in the board gaming world is not actually about board games, but about miniatures games. And that's Games Workshop's prices, shares, went down 24%, I believe.
Wow.
Which was a pretty big deal because for the last, now, a couple decades, they've kind of run miniature gaming with Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy Battles. You know, you go to any store, you can see that stuff. And they've been kind of ham-fisted. One would call them somewhat unkind to their consumers. And so there seems to be quite a bit of rejoicing over this. I'm not sure I'm on that side, even if I do think they're run by a bunch of big, meanie jerks. but it may have to change how they their policies are run in the future. It will be very interesting, that's for sure.
Well, that's really surprising to me. I mean, we're seeing in the Kickstarter space, certainly anything that has miniatures in it is exploding and getting huge amount of profits on Kickstarter above and beyond their funding goals. And yet here's a company that focuses on miniatures not doing so well. I think that's kind of counterintuitive, no?
Well, I mean, the folks on the Kickstarter campaigns are probably showing their consumers they like them.
So that's really what it's about. It's this rejection of their business practices.
Well, I don't think it's a rejection, but I think that Games Workshop has always run a policy in a sense where their goal is to attract new players. They don't really seem to care that much about their existing base. You know, they want the mothers to come in and buy lots of armies for young teenagers. And then these kids are like, wait a minute, why am I paying so much for these models? Oh, yeah, okay, well, we don't want you anymore. Let's get some new teenagers. And that's really how they've kind of operated in the past. But now with the advent of the internet and print and play, three-dimensional stuff, and people making – and Kickstarter, they're suddenly getting a lot of opposition, some competition. So it's actually not counterintuitive. It actually makes sense. These Kickstarters are drawing some money from Games Workshop.
Interesting. Now, I'm not really familiar with the sort of negative the negative connotation to Games Workshop. What exactly are they doing that's off-putting to people? Is it just sort of pricing structure?
Well, the first thing they did was their pricing. I used to play it myself, and they really clamped down hard a little over a decade ago over anybody having any sort of discount online. They would threaten them and pull the stuff from theirs. And now it's almost to the point where you can't sell it online unless you get it through them. Also, they have done cease and desist to pretty much anybody who even makes like a player aid for one of their games. Even if it's a game that's out of print, they come down extremely hard on those people. They've shut down forums in the past, and you know, you combine that with like their magazine, that comes out each month, or I don't know if it's even coming out anymore, which was basically just one big love fest. Look how awesome we are advertisement. And suddenly people realize these guys even like their customers. It certainly doesn't feel that way.
Do you think that this blow to their profits is going to result in a change to their business practices? Or do you think they're sitting up and taking notice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think so. What they will do, I don't know. Will they survive? I assume so. They're a pretty big company.
Interesting. In the chat room, Ultra Nerd with a U, Nerd, says that aren't minis doomed to the world of 3D printers? Do you have a feeling about that, Tom?
That may happen in 10, 15 years. I think it's still too expensive, and the models that are printed on 3D printers, while it's a neat concept, I want one, but they don't look as good as, you know, professionally sculpted models. I think at that point, we're going to see a resurgence in a change in the hobby. Just like role-playing games, they're having to deal with PDFs being downloaded right now. That's completely changed that hobby. So I think it will change the way that the hobby works. How it will change it, I'm not even going to pretend to guess, because probably some unforeseen thing.
Yeah, both Paizo and Wizards of the Coast seem to have embraced the PDF digital distribution model pretty well. But I'm sure they have to deal with a lot of piracy there as well. And it's a tricky thing. And I agree with you, man. I'd love to have a 3D printer, and I'd love to be able to make my own minis. And the idea of print and play, we're seeing print and play in board games being a really wonderful design tool and a wonderful way to people sort of test things out before they buy it, especially in the Kickstarter space. And I think in the mini space, that would be cool too. But you got to wonder if people will actually pay for things once they can print it out themselves.
I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of scared about the 3D printer thing. I remember the first time I got a dot matrix printer and found that there was a program for the Commodore 64 that made posters. And I was like, oh, and I just started printing out posters for nothing, you know, like, hey, Tom's room. And if I had a 3D printer, I feel like I would do the same thing. Ooh, I made a fire truck. What are you going to do with it? I don't know, but I could do it. Ha ha. Let's make something else. And I think you would come to my house and find a room full of plastic stuff.
It's, oh man, Christian, what do you think about?
You could make a plastic box to store all your plastic fire trucks in. Like, the possibilities are endless here.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I think it's interesting that, you know, and there's kind of a split going on, right? Where, like, this is an example of a corporation or a company kind of, you know, ratcheting down on their IP and making that, taking that firm stance on their IP, and somewhat kind of in like a video game analogy, the way Nintendo approached people using their IPs on YouTube videos and Let's Play videos, where they were like, you can clamp have down. Those videos up there, right? But we are clamping down, and we are going to take any revenues that come in through that, versus other companies that have really embraced this kind of digital age where they're, you know, super supportive of their community, and anything that the fans do is awesome. I mean, I guess kind of like the Witcher games is that CD Projekt.
And CD like, Projekt Red.
CD Projekt Red. Yeah, thank you. You know, no DRM, you know, buy our games. They're cheap. They're out there. We know that people are going to pirate them, but like, we're really supportive of our community. And I feel like there are two, you know, polar forces working here. And I don't know if anyone knows which one will win in the long term. I know which one I certainly prefer, but I understand people trying to protect their IP also in these brands that they built for years, you know?
Yeah, it's an interesting time, because I think that we're going to see, I mean, I can envision a whole world of 3D printing that gets beyond just sort of little plastic bits, and when we can actually sort of have machined parts that all work together, and all of a sudden the idea of IP is really the only thing you can sell. If I have the equivalent to Star Trek: The Next Generation's replicator, you know, I can make anything in my house, then the idea of something, the design of something, is really the only thing that's valuable, because, you know, other than the raw materials that I need to print it myself, I don't have to worry about manufacturing. And of course, that's, you know, decades in the future, but it's a future, and it's one that it's foreseeable. I think that it's going to have repercussions in the whole world, even beyond gaming, but maybe that's a discussion for another time. All right. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's kind of where we are now, right? All you're changing is the ease in manufacturing, right? I mean, the thing that is protected, and this is just dumb legalese. I mean, it's not, never the idea. An idea can't be protected, but it would be the design or, you know, the blueprints to put the things together. And you can do that now. It's just the cost of entry, obviously, to machine something is much higher. But I don't know if we'll, in our lifetimes, Jeff, I don't think we'll get to replicator Star Trek phase. I mean, 3D printers are cool, but I mean, let's be honest. How much do you see them progressing in the next 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, there's no way I'll be able to build an iPhone with a 3D printer, right? Like, it's not going to make Gorilla Glass.
I plan to live more than 20 years. I'll tell you that.
Not the way you live your life, fast and
right.
Great.
That's me, Mr.
He just
fast
gave you an end date. I don't know, though. I'm afraid to say how far technology, because I would never have predicted the smartphone 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's Star Trek technology that we have, right? That's full on Star Trek technology. I remember going to the Star Trek touring thing about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, and it was when I first had the very first iPhone, and there was a case, and they had props from the show, and there was the communicator there with it, and I was like, I have one of those in my pocket right now. I have that exact thing. So, you know, science fiction becomes reality a lot quicker than we think. All right, Christian, I have a feeling that your story of the week contender is going to be a lot less about board games, right?
Well, it can be related to board games. And so this is a story that hasn't had a full story written up about it. But what I'm going to venture as my story of the week, and Patrick Klepek over at Giant Bomb was tweeting about it this morning, and there's been buzz about it on NeoGAF, and whether or not that there should be some kind of quality control on Steam. And so this might get disqualified from story of the week because there hasn't been an official write-up, you know, somewhere on Joystick or Shack News or anywhere like that. But there's been several threads about it on NeoGAF, and I think it's continuing to pick up steam. Heyo, nailed it. And I think it's warrants the discussion today, and I think it plays into board games with, you can extrapolate this. Should there be quality control on Steam or on Kickstarter, or do you believe in an Adam Smith, you know, invisible hand, open market, more is better, and we'll weed out, you know, the poor stuff as consumers, or should the, I don't know what Steam would be called, the aggregator of these goods in some way have a quality control aspect to the thing that they allow to come out on their platform? What do you think?
Is it just a Wild West kind of like catch as catch can, and you know, if you pay $20 for the thing, if it's not ready, that's, you know, that we weed it out in the market because the guy who buys it for $20 will tell his friends not to buy it for $20, and therefore those things won't happen as much anymore. Tom, I heard you talk about recently on your show about the fact that you don't review the print yourself board games because you feel like there is a level of quality control that they don't go through because they're not going through a publisher. Is that kind of how you feel in this space as well?
Kind of yes and kind of no, because I don't know the video game space as well. I'll tell you what I do, though. When I go to Steam and I'm in one of my moods and I say, okay, I'm going to download a game, I look at the games and they look cool, and I'm going through the different games that are available. And of course, I use a Mac, so I have about 1/100th of the choices everybody else has. But when I'm looking at them, I'll see a great game. Then I go and I read every review I can find on that game until I get bored of reading them, because I want to get as much opinion as possible. So I kind of use that as a gatekeeper for me, the reviewers. But when it – because in the – I know that in the past I've seen some pretty cool stuff come from indie video game designers. And, you know, so I don't want to discount everything, although some companies, when I see that a specific company has made it, it has an automatic, oh, well, it must be at least a little good. And that's how I feel in the board game world. If a bigger board game publisher publishes a game, well, at least more than one guy thought it was good. When it's just a guy publishing a board game and he says his family loves it, what he's really saying is they love him. Not enough to tell him that his game is not good. And so I prefer gatekeepers, but that doesn't mean sometimes there are those shining gems in the rough.
Yeah. I feel I have a hard time with this because I think a lot of it speaks to this new culture, especially on Steam, of playing games before they're done. And I mean, I just had somebody delivered a board game to my house that was a prototype game, and it was all handmade and you know, cardboard stuck with a pin through it to make a little wheel and stuff. And
is Jeff Canada here? We got a board game delivery. It's not quite done, but
yeah. And I've also been playing this week Divinity Original Sin on Steam Early Access because I was so excited about Divinity. And to be honest with you, the PR company reached out and said, hey, do you want an early access code? And I'm not going to say no because I was so excited about this game. And it really is a game that's kind of made for me. I mean, this is a turn-based combat system, a top-down isometric role-playing game. I mean, top-down isometric is my favorite sort of perspective in video games. It reminds me of when I was a kid playing Ultima. And so I'm already sort of a geek for those games anyway. And I love turn-based combat systems. I love role-playing games in general. The graphics are fantastic in this game. It just looks great. It's got a very deep dialogue system and really interesting combat mechanics. But I hopped into this early access pre-alpha version of the game, and which they're selling, you know, and I don't know what's really part of the game or what's just temporary and placeholder. I mean, there's things where you scroll over with your mouse and it says not active for alpha, you know, and so it's like, well, I don't know what is there. If there's a thing I don't like about this game, is it just because it's the alpha version and it's not actually going to be that way in the final shipped version? Or so I don't even really want to play it very much because I don't know how to even take on what's happening. I don't know whether to attribute it to just, you know, it's not done yet or what. And I feel like that's the same way with prototype board games is I don't know how to judge it. So even reviews that come out of stuff that's not done in this whole new play it before it's finished version of releases, I don't know how to trust that even. So that complicates things too.
So I'm going to try to distill what you said, Jeff. You're saying you it seems to me that you're in favor of quality control, but you're hesitant to say that you want someone playing like a dictatorial role saying what comes out and what doesn't. But the reason you're in favor of quality control is because you think things should only be able to come out when they're finished? Is that somewhat
yes, that's
accurate?
The translation. Yeah, no, I know. I was kind of rambly there. And it's because I'm not really sure how I feel about all this stuff. I mean, it's true that it's exciting that there aren't gatekeepers or that the gatekeepers are less empowered than they have been. So
gatekeepers
that you have,
like doors in zombie movies. Like you think they're closed, but all you need to do is lean on it. And like a thing that can't even walk above 2 miles an hour can bust a wood door down, right?
Right. And in that analogy, I don't necessarily want to be playing the zombie version of a, you know, a game. I want to be playing the fully human, alive version of the game. We're stretching the analogy. Let's be
perfect.
Honest.
It's perfect.
I think that the free market actually does fix this, though. I mean, you're not going to see very often, it does happen, where a game that's not very good sells tons and tons of copies, and people are very irritated on a large scale about how bad it is. When a game is bad and it comes out, the early reviews will often kill it because there are people who are willing to be they're willing to fall on the grenade for the rest of us. I mean, that's one of the things that reviewers do, but there's people who find these smaller things. So I don't really care about the gatekeepers. I just wish that my desire is for designers to pay attention to this. When a designer emails me and he says, I'm thinking about publishing my own game, my first response is always, don't. You know, don't. You know, find someone else to publish it for you. And if the response is, well, I showed it to several publishers and they don't want it, well, then your game is probably bad. Now, I don't say that, but that's what I want to say. I kind of say that, you know, if all these publishers are refusing – yeah, I just said it now. But if all these publishers are refusing your game, why do you think it will succeed outside of them? I mean, that does happen on occasion. But it, you know, usually not. If your game is that fantastic, it will catch someone's eye.
Yeah, you want to encourage the believe in yourself thing, but it's like, yeah, believe in yourself up to a point, and then have some other people believe in you as well. I get that as well. My story that we've been talking about this stuff ad nauseum. It seems like every week we've been talking about Nintendo, but there was another huge Nintendo story this week, and I think it
they
really
sold
is
a console.
No, sadly, it's the opposite of that. it continues to be the opposite of that. And I think it's really hard to deny that this is the biggest story of the week, that, you know, Iwata, the head of Nintendo, came out and had a financial meeting, had a discussion with his financial backers and kind of outlined the plan going forward to right the ship. We talked either last week or the week before a lot about how Nintendo had to downgrade their projection of profits drastically and had to reconfigure their numbers on how many Wii U's they were going to sell and how many 3DS's they were going to sell, and everything took a sharp downturn. And there was a lot of speculation as to whether Iwata was going to have to step down. He is not stepping down. In fact, his plan, as outlined by this financial meeting, kind of shows a doubling down on a lot of the things that some of us feel are the downside of the Wii U, i.e. the tablet itself, saying that they are going to really make a big, strong push for software to make use of the tablet and show what is unique and interesting about that, to make a quicker startup time for the Wii U. They say that will help in people's perception of the system, that they may experiment with flexible pricing points for people that are really loyal to Nintendo, that people that buy more Nintendo games may end up actually being able to save money in the long term on additional games, which is kind of a cool thing. And the strangest bit of news about this is that the Wall Street Journal reported that Nintendo's main theme for the next 10 years, according to Iwata, will be enhancing the quality of life through entertainment, and health being a major part of that. So all the stuff that they have done in previous years with Wii Fit and with the Brain Age series of games on the DS is going to be a major part of their business going forward. So I have to say, a lot of this does not give me a lot of confidence in Nintendo, but I'm curious as to what you guys think. Tom, you have a whole bunch of kids. In fact, we almost didn't get you today because you are about to have another child yeah. in the next few days. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. Well, let me ask you this, though. You mentioned that they said they were going to be working on the tablet more and doing more with that. Why do you think that's a bad idea?
Well, I'm of two minds about it, to be honest with you. I think it is the clear differentiator between the Wii U and other consoles. It is their strong suit to a large degree, but it also hasn't been used in a way that makes me excited about its potential. So a lot of us were speculating that maybe the best idea would be to just kind of cut it out of the console altogether, use a simpler controller, and reduce the price of the console. And it seems that that tablet is not cheap to make. So if they maybe cut it out, and just since most of their games don't use it in any unique way anyway, it might be smart to just sort of trim the fat and make the price point lower so that they can sell more of them.
Well, let me say this as a parent. We just got the Wii U for Christmas because I'm allowed to say this on the show or not, but I'm kind of a Nintendo guy. You know, they've done well with me except for the 64 over the years. And the tablet, I bought some game, I forget the name of it. It's like Nintendo Land or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, there's a game where one person is running away from everybody else on the tablet. Everyone else is chasing them.
Right.
And there's another game where someone's hunting everyone. They're a ghost and they're hunting other people. And those two games that use the tablet as its own thing are by far the most fun thing we do as a family, period, on that system. And I wish there was more like that. And I can't find anything else that really seems that way. So if they say they're going to work more on that, to us, that would get us really excited.
Yeah, I think you speak volumes there. I mean, that is clearly the best use of that tablet is that asymmetric, you know, one person's doing one thing over here and other people are doing something completely different in the same game. And that's really exciting. And it's baffling as to why Nintendo hasn't done more with that or shown the potential. And it, maybe you're right. Maybe this is doubling down on that might be a smart move and say, hey, you really can have a completely unique experience on the Nintendo console. Christian, tell us why we're wrong.
Here's the problem. The tablet isn't a quality piece of hardware. It's a single touch, low res screen. And while it can be extremely fun, and I'm very glad that Tom and his family have a lot of fun with it. I've had fun with it on, you know, get togethers, where a lot of friends come over. But it's few and far between, and I feel like, unfortunately, you know, families like Tom's are in the minority when it comes to selling the amount of hardware needed to attract third-party publishers to a system that are needed for a console maker to generate the revenue required off of third-party licensing for making games on a console, and also not big enough to get the install base up to support itself alone, well, like the Wii did. Hold on. Here comes the last boom. and the thing about them switching to this health and whatever they're trying to double down on, I think shows how lost they still are, because they're like, ooh, the Wii Fit sold well for us. Let's do that again. And they're trying, instead of creating their own path, they're reacting to things. The tablet's a reaction to the iPad, and this health and whatever is a reaction to things that sold well for them during the Wii. And I don't think they know what they're doing. And I think instead of Iwata stepping down, he's going to get pushed down, because there's only so much that investors can take. Despite the mountains of cash that Nintendo's standing on, they're going to get frustrated. And I think it's going to happen sooner than later.
Well, I will say this. The last generation directly proves the opposite of your point, in that the Wii was directly targeted at families. It provided an experience very different from anybody else. It did not rely on third-party support to make it profitable. It was the most profitable system of that generation, and it opened up a whole group of video game players and purchasers who never had done it before, because it was an accessible system to families. So if that's the game they want to play, it seems like they have a proven track record of making that successful. If they provide software like Tom is talking about that is actually exciting and interesting for families, and it provides a complete alternative to these other two consoles that are fighting it out for the 15-year-old boys who want to shoot stuff.
Right, that's the thing. I mean, as someone who likes to play video games, the Xbox and the PlayStation are really interesting, but they're not systems that I really want to get for my family. Yeah. The Wii was such a solid success with us that I figured the Wii U. I should have known, because Nintendo seems to go up and down, and this is the Wii U is the down system. But I'm hoping I didn't back a sinker here. So I'm hoping some good games come out for it.
Well, that's what Nintendo has to convince everybody, that it isn't a sinker, so that more people want to jump on. I mean, that's the whole idea. It's baffling to me that they would go, oh, maybe we should make some software that uses the tablet. It's like, well, maybe you should have thought about that when you invented the tablet, like when you put the tablet in the system. Why didn't somebody go, hey, this Nintendo Land thing isn't just a one-off. Maybe we should use this tablet in some more interesting ways. It's absolutely unbelievable to me that the next big Nintendo marquee game that's coming out, which is Donkey Kong Country, it is not using the tablet in any way. Literally, the screen on the tablet will be blank while you play that game, which it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I understand wanting to make a great Donkey Kong Country game. I love Donkey Kong Country and I'm excited for it. But if what you're worried about is justifying the idea of this tablet, how can you allow your first party to come out with games that don't use it at all? And Mario Kart is another example. The screen is just a giant horn button to, you know, that's not using it. I don't understand why it took them this long to wake up to that.
Because they're not waking up to it. They're scrambling to justify it. I think when the Wii came out, you know, this was like, this needs to exist, and here's why. And they had this great use case for it, this great piece of software. And then they had kind of unlimited other examples of software that Nintendo thought, you know, there wasn't this needs to exist, and here's how we're going to use it. And when the Wii U came out, they were like, well, here's some ways you can use it. And here's some other ways you can use it. And well, here's some off-screen stuff. And well, I don't know, the DS is kind of cool. And look, it's like a big TV remote. And I don't know. I don't know what we're doing. I don't, just buy it, please. And I mean, I feel bad. And I've been on this course since almost day one when it was unveiled. They don't know what they're doing. And I think sales have proven me correct, and I think, unfortunately, they'll continue to prove me correct, and I don't think that there's this, I don't think Nintendo is sitting on some genius idea to make the tablet desirable to people. I mean, I think to some extent, Nintendo fans, myself included, are still nostalgic for the days of four people sitting around the Nintendo 64 playing GoldenEye or Mario Kart 64, but gaming has moved from that, you know, that's not the standard way people game anymore. And people that like that experience, I think, and I think Jeff, you can agree with this at least some, is that people have gone to designer board games and they've filled that niche that used to maybe be video games. Whereas, you know, people, designer board games weren't as popular, at least I wasn't aware of them. And I'm going to argue that my perspective is everybody's in the early 90s. And people have maybe gravitated that way, and video gaming has become, you know, an online experience and not five kids sitting around a TV. Am I completely off base with that?
Well, first of all, nostalgia with Nintendo is Super Mario Brothers, not GoldenEye. Come on now. you're not going back far enough.
No, but, four-player nostalgia is GoldenEye.
Oh, four-player. Okay. Secondly, though, I think Nintendo's biggest thing is basically the smartphone or the iPad or all that. Yeah. You know, that's what's hitting them harder than anything else, because that's what families are gravitating towards now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems like the 3DS is still selling pretty well, but yes, I think that's why we all think that the tablet got thrown into this system, is they went, oh, we'll put a tablet in our system so people don't have to buy an iPad. They'll get one with the new Nintendo system.
I was hoping your announcement from Nintendo was going to be, we were going to see Super Mario for the iPad.
Well, they did say, Iwata did say that they will actively, quote unquote, actively use smart devices to, quote, make connections with consumers.
That means nothing.
That seems to mean that they're going to put out advertising on smartphones. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of hope there. He did say that they are committed to continuing to make hardware and make software for that hardware. So it doesn't seem like they're going to be putting out games for other people's hardware anytime soon. I want to go to the phones and find out what you guys think about some of this stuff. And also, if you have any board gaming questions for Tom, I think that'd be awesome too. But first, we have to thank our sponsor, New Relic. New Relic is a software analytics company that helps make sense of billions of metrics across millions of applications all in real time. As you may have heard, it's 2014 now, and one thing people are really focused on this year is seamless application performance across multiple platforms on all of their devices. That means smart devices, it means desktops, it means laptops. It sounds simple, but making an app work consistently on lots of different devices, all with different operating systems, running different types of software, is super complex. How complex? Well, in the old days, like 2007, it was basically impossible for an app developer to know how his or her app was performing once it got shipped to production. Remember that? You'd spend all your time doing internal bug hunts and then eventually just cross your fingers and hope for the best. Then you'd sit around monitoring Twitter and app stores just trying to find out if your apps were performing well or not. Thankfully, those days are now officially behind us, because New Relic lets us track application performance down to the end user level all in real time. This means you can spot problems, find bugs, and fix your code fast, way before users even notice anything is wrong. So you get around that whole bad press, bad reviews. You are ahead of the game. So go and check out New Relic by visiting newrelic.com/DLC to learn more. And you'll get the offer. We have a special offer code, DLC30, when you check out. And you get to take advantage of a special 30-day extended free pro trial. That's available exclusively to listeners of DLC at newrelic.com/DLC with the promo code DLC. I've actually been hearing about people using this not just as app developers, but as a way to monitor your own PC or your own tablet to find out how well it's working and monitor performance. It's really great. And we appreciate them supporting the show. We hope you support them in return. Again, newrelic.com/DLC. Use that promo code DLC.
You hear that, Nintendo? Use the promo code DLC. Go to New Relic. Figure out how to make an app. We know it
there
took you forever to use HD graphics, apparently. This can help you out. We're trying to help, Nintendo. See, we're trying to help.
So we're going to go to the phones. Again, that number is 512-518-5714. We're going to find out what we got, what you guys think about some of this stuff. We got a caller from a 412. What do you think about Nintendo's doubling down? Are you ready for more health applications on your Nintendo console?
Not exactly. I used it for like a week and gave up on it.
Okay.
I still feel like the biggest problem the Wii U faces, oddly, I think, is the 3DS in a weird way. Because every game that I feel like it's been worth playing on the Wii U is kind of like a spiritual successor to a 3DS game I've already played, so it's harder to get excited for the game. It's like you had New Super Mario Brothers 2 come out on the 3DS right before the Wii U launched, and then so when Super Mario Brothers Wii, or U, whatever they called it, when that came out, I was like, I just kind of played this a few months ago, and you know, 3D Land, BCAT, 3D World, and so on and so forth. Do you guys feel that's the case?
Yeah, well, I think it speaks to this idea that software is the issue. Once there is really exciting software on that system, people will rush out and buy it. And we're starting to see that tide turning a little bit. But again, the exciting software is, oh, Mario Kart. Yeah, I've played Mario Kart for 10 years now, you know, so it's hard to get excited about something really new. But I think that what do you guys think about this idea that they're actually going to be porting old DS software to the Wii U? Do you think that adds a little bit of excitement to the Wii U, or has it sort of been here, done that?
Will it do something different?
No, it's basically a way to play. It's like their virtual console. It's a way to mine the nostalgia a little more and say, well, there's, you know, these hundreds and hundreds of games that were made on DS. Now you can play them on Wii U because it's got the two screens. It's got the touchpad. So, hey, we've got this whole back catalog to choose from as well. You're going to have to rebuy it, but there it is.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I mean, I think there are billions or millions and millions and millions of DSs around. If people wanted to play those games, they could play them. I don't think people are dying to sit on their couch and play them. I think it's too little, too late. Maybe if the Wii U launched with that. I also think it'd be better if it had a cart port for it, kind of like the GameCube's Game Boy Advance add-on. I know that was an add-on, but I think that's a better solution somehow if they're a way to use your actual cart instead of rebuying them. And also, I think the caller had a good point where, I mean, and I think you can see this from Smash Brothers coming out on the 3DS and the Wii U, where it's even Nintendo isn't, you know, willing to go all in on their Wii U. You want to play Mario? Well, you've got 3D Land on the 3DS. Is it as good as 3D World? Maybe not, but it gets you pretty close. I'd say there are more good games to play on the 3DS than the Wii U. And when you have them splitting their properties like that, it's a hard case to make to buy the more expensive console when you'd be buying it exclusively to play Nintendo properties. So I don't think now adding in old DS games gets you there.
All right. Well, you know, we've been talking about the problem with Nintendo week after week. So I'm going to move, since we have Tom here, I'm going to move right into tabletop time. Tabletop time! So we can get to that sooner and get talking about board games, which is what I'm super excited about talking about this week. The first thing I want to talk about, Tom, I don't know, I've listened to a lot of your stuff, but I haven't really heard you specifically talk about Nothing Personal, the design process of that. I know you and Steve Avery worked on it together, and that it's based on an old game that you kind of wanted to redo. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was an old game that was out in the 80s, I believe, was when it first came out, called Kremlin. It was printed by Avalon Hill, and it was about the internal struggles of the Kremlin. But it was done almost in a silly sort of way because, you know, while sending someone off to Siberia is pretty terrible in real life, in this game, everybody kind of cheered. and you would have, you were secretly controlling the different people in the Kremlin and maneuvering it so that your folks were in the top tier. You were trying to become the premier for a few turns, and then you would win the game. And I liked it, but board games from the 70s and 80s are a little clunky when you play them today. Board games have really evolved to the point where when you play a game from the 70s and 80s, with a few exceptions, there's some games that have held up over time. Most of them show their age. You know, we don't like to look at chart after chart after chart anymore to figure things out. And some people have invented some cool mechanisms. So that was the idea. The catalyst was a boring teacher meeting, which I found is the catalyst for a lot of things I get done, since teacher stuff never seems to get done in one of those meetings. They give you a sheet, then they proceed to read that sheet, and then people ask questions that they could have had answered if they had just read the sheet. So, you know, you do that for a while. So I just wrote down the idea. I had the idea, and I said, whoa, wait a minute. And I just kept writing and writing and writing until I was done. Immediately typed it up, emailed it to Steve, said, what do you think? And he said, well, and then he sent me a bunch of changes back. We just went back and forth on that for a while until we had a pretty workable idea. And then it was just a lot of playing. You know, the first time I brought it to my play group, I said, play this game. And they just tore it up and said, man, mistake here. This is a problem. They hated it. I said, all right, I'll let the designer know. And, you know, if there's one thing about my play group, no, they knew I designed it. But if there's one thing about my play group is they're not shy in telling me what they think of things. Right. I don't have the – I always hear – you know, I always talk about these designers whose parents and family members say, oh, your game is so great. I have like the opposite. I could have a – I could design Ticket to Ride, you know, and my family would have been like, that's garbage.
Well, so
you know, we play tested it some more, and then we got to a point where I said, hey, I think we can get this published.
Now, did you come to the Mafia theme right away, or did you – was it a game before it was a theme, or did they – you know,
I am contractually obligated to say Stephen Bonacore, the president of Stronghold Games, gave me the idea and said that it was a better idea than the Kremlin, because kids these days don't really get the whole I'd rather be dead than red thing that was going on in the 80s. And so I said, yeah, there's not enough good gangster games out there anyway. So it was an easy switch.
That's cool. It's a fantastic game, and it's getting a ton of great buzz. And I think the most impressive thing about it is the component quality. Is that something you really fought for, or how did that come about, getting really thick cardboard, these wonderful coins that you've got in the game, and a ring, a full on ring that you can wear so you can tell people to kiss your ring?
Yeah, that actually came from there was a group playing at a convention, and at that point the ring was on a card, and so a guy was making people kiss the card, and I said, well, that'd be great if it was an actual ring. The component quality, sure. I think games should be as high quality as you can afford. Now, obviously, there's some problems with Nothing Personal. It wasn't as perfect as I would have liked it to have been, but. But yes, the money, I mean, I can't – when I open a game and it's garbage components, it just – it bothers me. I don't care how great the game is. It's just not as fun to play. The cooler the stuff is, when you have thick money and you throw that on the table, it feels better than when you drop some paper money that's only printed on one side that then ripped as you dropped it. You know, who looks more threatening? A guy with some pink paper, or a guy throwing down some cardboard, you know – pieces that when they hit the table, it rattles. That's more menacing.
Exactly. So was it really a difficult fight to get that? I mean, was that a compromise of, okay, well, that's going to raise the price of the game?
Well, in this instance, no, because of Kickstarter. Because we went with Kickstarter and they priced everything out, and the project manager for Kickstarter was the same guy who did the very first Kickstarter, Alien Frontiers, or one of the first Kickstarters. And so he knew the ins and outs, and he said, if we get a certain amount of money, we can then do this. Some of the things that you think are more expensive in the game weren't as pricey as others. And then I was just kept pushing it. You know, I said, I want the cardboard to be as thick as it possibly can. And when they told me how thick it was, which is really thick, I said, thicker. And finally, they talked me down from that, which is probably good because the box is heavy enough as it is.
Yeah, it really does make a huge difference. You really feel like, oh, wow, this is a quality game when you unbox it. And bravo to you for doing that. I mean, I think It must be, as somebody who is outspoken on board games and has so many reviews under his belt, it must be, I mean, I know your first game, Vicious Fishes, which has one of the best titles of a board game ever, did not get the kind of positive buzz you're getting now. So is it challenging as being somebody who's out in front as a reviewer to also kind of put your neck on the line and say, well, this is what I make as well?
Well, there's positives and negatives. The positive was, if I email a company and say, I have a game that I think is pretty good, I know I can get them to look at it. Mm-hmm. All right. And there's also people who will buy the game because my name's on the box. Right. At the same time, the negatives are, yes, people are going to hold me to a higher standard. The rules weren't very well written in this game. And because I have screamed about that in the past, people rightly so dragged me over the coals for that. And then as a reviewer, you tend to make enemies as time goes by. And I can see several of these people went and rated the game quite lowly right away. You know, revenge time. You rated my game low? Ha, ha, ha. But for the most part, it's been a pretty positive experience.
So as long as nobody throws it off their roof, right?
Well, actually, someone did do that. And I was all for that. Someone actually blew it apart with a shotgun, which was which was a very high honor for me. I think it was
Joel Eddy who did that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. That's fun. That's very funny.
So how do you, Tom, walk, you know, a foot in both worlds, right? As a reviewer and designer, a critic and a creator, I mean, is there a hat you find more enjoyable between the two? Or do you think, you know, the more time you plunge into the creator world, the easier it is to review someone else's games? Or are you of the type where you think, you know, film critics shouldn't make films and, you know, video game reviewers are best if they know as little about the process as possible, or board game makers, because, oh, I don't want to sympathize that, you know, Tomb Raider ran over budget because I know how hard it is to make a game, or that your board game, the rules are not as clear as they could be, but I know how hard it is to get rules right on a first draft. Instead, no, I'm representing the consumer. I'm a reviewer and a critic, and I just want to look at the end product. Or do you think knowing the process helps in a review?
Okay. I think you just asked 50 questions, but
27 by my count.
Are you saying that Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is not a good movie?
Obviously, it's Roger Ebert's famous script.
Too soon, Tom. Too soon.
I designed a game, and I actually have a couple more designs that I toy with every once in a while. But the fact is, I'd rather be a reviewer. I'd rather someone else do it. It seems to be a common thing these days where people say, inside, everyone is a designer. Well, keep him inside, most people. You know, let's let the people who are good at it do it. Now, I mean, I think you could try to get it out. But, I mean, most people are going to be mediocre designers. That's how life is. Most people are mediocre at most things, and you're really good at some things. I like tearing apart other people's games. Am I nicer now that I see what it's like? Sometimes. Am I meaner on other aspects because I've seen, like, that was something you could have easily fixed type situation. Designers are people, and I do understand what it's like for them to watch one of my negative reviews, because I watched some negative reviews or read negative reviews, and I said, I'm not going to get mad because I know what it's like. And when it was over, I was a little mad, and I said, come on now, that guy didn't know what he was talking about. You know, but I can't do that, you know, so I know what's – it actually has worked for me on the other end, because I know what it's like now to be a reviewer better, seeing when other people review my game.
Jeff, where are you on that? Like, I think it comes up in the video game space somewhere, you know, some game journalists or reviewers or whatever you want to call them argue, you know, knowing about the process actually hurts their job as a reviewer versus knowing nothing about how video games are made and just looking at the final finished game is all that they should consider. Do you have an opinion one way or the other?
Oh, I think knowing more is always better in almost every sense. Knowing more about something is almost always better. I think where it when people bring it up, I think it's more about knowing the individual people involved and not wanting to hurt people's feelings when you become friends with the people that make the thing that you're now being critical of. And that's a tough situation, because when you work in an industry that's as small as these industries we're talking about, you tend to rub elbows with people at events, at press situations, and you get to know them. And because they like the same things you like and are doing the same things that you're interested in doing, then all of a sudden you become buddies, and then they put out something that you have to be critical of, and it may be not a very pleasant experience to have to criticize something that you know the person who put their heart and soul into it.
I think I might be on the other side, and maybe I'm alone on an island, but I'm trying to think of an example like GTA 5, whatever, right? I don't know really anything about how hard it is to make games, or, you know, what goes into getting a game like GTA 5 on the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. I just know that when I played that game, as beautiful as the city looked, it felt like a ghost town version of that city, where, you know, they made the city so big that the streets were now so sparse that, to me, that took away from the immersion of what I think the game was trying to convey. And so if I were to have reviewed that game, I would have pointed that out as a negative aspect, whereas a game, you know, a more linear game that's probably easier to design because there are less AI routines, you know, can, like The Last of Us, can have an area full of guys and full of AI routines. And to me, it made for a more compelling experience. Now, if I knew maybe what GTA 5 was able to do on a software side of things is far more incredible than anything The Last of Us did. But I don't think that knowledge should give GTA 5, you know, a better score. And so I don't know if knowing it...
I don't think it would. I think you can be aware of the limitations of something and still say, well, it would be better if it had that. Yeah, I think you can have both those conflicting thoughts in your head at the same time and still make a reasonable critique. I don't think it necessarily has to inform you in that particular way.
Okay. I guess my concern is just the thought would be, they did so much. Wow, they really maxed out the system. This is awesome because I know that this is the most you could do versus, you know what? This isn't what it should be. This sucks.
I think that speaks more to a design sensibility, not a sort of technical sensibility. It's not that, well, they pushed the hardware to its limit and this is the best they could do. It's that the design makes me feel a certain way. And if it was designed differently, I wouldn't feel that way within the context of that. You know, 20 years ago, people were talking about how great graphics were. And they weren't as great as they are now. So it's all within the context of what's possible. And it's all about the design feeling like it works in that particular context. I think that's it's not necessarily a, you know, well, technical specs are X, therefore I think Y. It's more like, well, the way this world welcomes me in, the way it makes me feel moment to moment is a certain way. And if they had treated things differently, maybe I wouldn't feel like the technical thing was a technical thing at all.
No, I think that's a good point. And now I'd like to transition into the part of the show I called Christian Opens a Can of Carbonated Water.
Well done.
Done.
Okay, let's take this call. We got a caller on the line from 208 area code. Do you have a board game question for Tom?
Yeah, I do have a board game question for Tom. Really awesome to be talking to you guys. Thanks.
Yeah,
I was wondering if Tom, if you've had a chance to play Duel of Ages 2, and if it is worth getting if you own the original.
Duel of Ages, for those who don't listen, is a game that basically brings Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure to life, where you have all these different people from time and space picking up different weapons and fighting each other. It's like a glorified bloodbath of awesomeness. Duel of Ages 2 is almost a reboot. I would say it's worth owning because it's better in almost every way. Now, it's not as – I was hoping they would streamline it, make it a little bit new person friendly, and they didn't. They actually made it bigger and more grandiose. But if you like the first one, you'll like this one. It's basically everything from Duel of Ages and all of its expansions, but just done in a better way. The battle system is better. The cards – are better quality. The whole thing has a much better, higher component quality about it. I enjoy it more and got rid of Duel of Ages 1 on the spot.
And wasn't Duel of Ages out of print? You couldn't actually get it for a while, is that right?
Well, you probably could find it on eBay. I think the guy who sold them was selling them on eBay slowly for several years. I think you couldn't get all the expansions, but you could get the game.
That is definitely one that's on my list. I never played the original Duel of Ages, and I'm excited about the sequel. I heard you talking about it on your show as well, and I know it's one of your favorite games of all time. I'm dying to play it. I have yet to try it. But I did play this week a couple of newer games, one of which I know you're really enthusiastic about, and that is Lost Legends from Queen Games and designer Mike Elliott, who also designed Thunderstone and Quarriors. So two excellent games in his pedigree. And Lost Legends is a game where you get to create an awesome character who's a mage or a fighter or a thief or a ranged guy and dive into some dungeons and fight monsters and try to beat your friends by lasting longer than they can and getting more points, victory points than they can in some really interesting ways. You get bonuses for killing multiple of a same type of monster, and you get bonuses for killing sets of monsters of different types and being the first to do so, or being the person who's done it most often. I think the really interesting thing about that game is that it's got this drafting mechanic where you, before you delve into the dungeon, you get to select some equipment or spells or whatever to put on your character. And you do that by looking at a hand of six cards, picking one of those cards, and then passing the hand to the person to your left so that you continue to draft cards out of that set until you build your particular guy. That's a really interesting mechanic that's been in more and more games recently. I think it's put to really good use here. I know, Tom, you were really digging this game, right?
Yes, I still have the game, which speaks in – if you know my collection, that really speaks volumes. I really like the idea of taking cards from other people, you know, having a hand of cards, picking one and passing it on. And this game does that in a very good way.
Yeah. My only criticism with this game is that the combat is basically you're assembling a number. You've got your attack value either in magic or melee or ranged, and you can only use one of those values to attack the monster. So you decide which one, basically the highest one you've got, or the one that the monster doesn't have a counter to in some way. Some monsters will only take half damage by a certain type of attack. And then you determine whether your number is higher than its number. And I wish there was a little bit more drama in the battle system. It just feels like, oh, my number's higher, so I beat it, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, but I still remember playing the Final Fantasy series, you know, and you hit a guy and a bunch of numbers fly out of him. I mean,
you don't know what those numbers are going to be, though.
Well, that's true, but you see the system a little bit closer, I suppose. I understand that, and I like rolling dice and having some randomness, but I think in this game, it might add a little bit too much. I think for this game, the comparing two numbers is fine.
Yeah. You really do feel a sense of progression with your character over time, too, because there's three rounds of drafting. And by the third, you're using three different decks of items. And by the third deck, you're really getting some powerful stuff on your character. But also you're dealing with much more powerful monsters at that point. But it's a fun progression system. And the components are really fun. You get a little a cardboard tablet, basically, in front of you. That's your character guy. And you get to add in all the cards into little slots that are placed around the edges of that piece of cardboard. So it really does feel like you're assembling this character right in front of you. So it's cool. I just wanted a little bit more drama, a little more excitement in fighting the guys. And there's this level of strategy that they're trying to introduce by saying, shoot for sets or shoot for multiples or try to attain this bonus to your victory point at the end. But I found that there was not much choice that I had in which kind of monster I was facing. So I really couldn't play strategically in that way.
Well, pitch your, let's, as I just talked about reviewers and designers, maybe shouldn't be the same. Pitch your combat or steal combat from another game that you think would make this more, you know, dramatic and thrilling for you. Like, what are you looking for if this isn't enough?
Well, I mean, Tom said it. There's a million ways to do combat in board games, but, you know, dice, of course, is what's fun. It's like, okay, I can roll five dice because I have the stronger sword on instead of three dice because I was using the dagger. And now, but there's still drama in whether I'm going to roll high enough. I tend to like that. And again, that's a different game than what this game is, but
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, do you think that would fit this type of game? Or do you think, you know, the way that this game works, that, you know, maybe the card battle is what fits the rest of the game structure? Or is there a way, and Tom, feel free to chime in, that you could add drama to this game and have it still be this game?
Well, I mean, you could put anything in anything, really, but you know, I think that you know, you could add whatever into whatever. This is clearly the game that Mike Elliott wanted to make, but it just, for me, as exciting as it is to draft those items and create that guy, I wanted the actual combat system to be just as fun, and it just felt a little disconnected from the other players on the board, and it felt a little anticlimactic in the sense, like, it would, you know, it'd be my turn and I'd be like, oh, I get to one shot this guy because I'm so powerful, and it's like, well, good for you, Jeff, and like, yeah, I really got him, you know. I just wish there was more going on. Tom disagrees, obviously.
Well, no, I like the game. I know what you're saying, but in that instance, I think then there's other games that you should look towards.
Yeah. Well, do you have anything that you've been playing lately that you're enthusiastic about, you wanted to bring up?
I have something I'm super enthusiastic about. In fact, as soon as we're done, I'm going to play it. It's a game that's not out yet. The copy of my hands is just magic. It's called Marvel Dice Masters.
Ooh.
It's from WizKids. Have either of you played a game from WizKids called Quarriors?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Quarriors. I don't think Christian has played it, though.
I have
not. Well, essentially, this is a mix, a straight up mix. It's halfway between Quarriors and Magic the Gathering.
Oh, you got me excited now.
Well, I played it. It's very exciting. What you do in this game is you bring 8 heroes to battle, or villains. Right now, let's see. Here's my team I built while you were droning. Ghost Rider, Green Goblin, Mystique, Deadpool, Magneto, Doc Octopus, Loki, and Thing. I don't know why Thing's there. Maybe he's evil or something. So that's my team. And then each of those cards that I brought with me, I can bring with me a certain amount of dice. I have 20 dice total that I can bring. So for example, I brought 4 Ghost Rider dice, but I only brought 1 Loki dice. So I put all these dice in front of me, and then I'll start with 8 regular dice. They're sidekick dice. They're just like the regular dice in Quarriors. And on my turn, I can roll these dice, and I'm getting energy so that I can buy from these heroes that I brought. Like, I might, if I roll 6 energy, I might get Doc Octopus. So I'll take his die and add it to my pool of dice that I'll be pulling from a bag and rolling. And once you roll when you roll these dice, they produce energy. But on the dice, they also show the characters. And when you roll the character, you'll place that character in front of you. That character has like an energy cost that it costs to deploy him. And then they have an attack and defense. And then on your turn, you can use these dice to attack the other person once they've been deployed, and they can use any dice that they have to deploy to defend. Just like Magic, each person has 20 life, and so if a die gets through, no one blocks him, they'll do that much damage to the opposing player, and the first person to make the other person go down to 0 life is the winner. But each of these cards they give special abilities. Like, for example, the Thing, I use him. If my opponent has more dice on the field than me, I get to draw 3 extra dice. Loki, I can take over one of my opponent's dice. Doc Octopus, I can tie up one of my opponent's dice, and they can't use that die to block this turn. So not only that, though, is each of these characters has multiple itinerations. So there's actually 3 different Spider-Man cards, for example, that you can use.
Can you have 3 Spider-Man on your team at once?
Well, no, you would just have one
Clone
of them.
Saga.
You would just have one Spider-Man, but you can pick what kind of variation you're going to use, what special power.
Ah.
Now, this is a collectible game. When you buy it, you get a starter kit of 8 characters, and you get all 3 variations of those characters. So you have 24 different things to pick from. You get some starter dice and some extra dice that are used for special actions and so on. And then you can buy booster packs, and each booster pack comes with 2 dice and 2 cards that match those dice. But where I think they're going to make a lot of money, they're selling these booster packs for $1, 99 cents.
Wow, really?
And so, yes, wow. Really. So you're going to go to the store and you get 2 dice and 2 cards, a booster pack. Currently, booster packs like for Magic and other games are running $3, $4, $5.
Yeah.
So when you go and you see that these are $1 and they give you cool custom dice, I can easily see myself, you know, going in and saying, I got 20 bucks. I'll take 20 packs, or I guess tax. I'll take 18 packs, but whatever, you know, give me the packs. And I'm telling you, the game is fast and fun. I'm a big Magic the Gathering fan, and I'm a big Warriors fan, and putting these together. And what's even more awesome is that this is based in the Marvel Universe. Later on this year, they're releasing a DC game that would be compatible.
So you can finally have Thor versus Superman.
Yes. Well, they've already been doing this, WizKids, with their HeroClix game.
Right, right.
And they're also going to be making a Yu-Gi-Oh! Version, which I suppose is compatible. I'm not as excited about that, but since it will provide me with more cards, I don't care.
So the idea of these 99-cent packs is you would go walk in the store and go, I want to buy Wolverine, and that's the pack? Is that character?
No, it's random. There are commons, uncommons, and rares. But the good thing about this is – I'm not a huge fan of the CCG system. But the good thing about this is the rarity is the cards themselves. So no matter what Thor I'm using, the Thor dice are all the same. And there is – each character has a common, uncommon, and rare version. So if I want to use Spider-Man, I can. And the rare versions are cool and different than the common and uncommons. But if I mixed them up and I said, which one's the rare one without me looking, I wouldn't be able to tell. It's just different. Huh. I don't think that it's unlike Magic the Gathering, where the rare cards are often the best cards in the set. Right. I don't see that here. And when you buy a booster pack, you get two cards and a die for each card, you can instantly start using those. Let's say I get Hulk and one Hulk die. Well, that's all I need. I have 20 dice that I can bring, but I could bring just one for one character. So it's never like you're going to get a booster pack that you can't use.
So are booster packs more accepted in board gaming world than like DLC and like, say, this sounds kind of similar to how in-app purchases were for Mass Effect 3 multiplayer. I guess you didn't get to keep some of those things, but, you know, or collectible card games, I feel like don't get the backlash the way downloadable content or add-ons for video games do. Is it just because it's been around longer, or do people hate?
Is downloadable content ever randomized?
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I the only downloadable content I've ever used, I play Borderlands 2. And I download stuff and it's like a mini expansion.
Oh, well, like in Mass Effect 3 multiplayer, you know, you would buy boosts for a match. And what you got, I mean, where the card packs in Madden are this idea, or in NBA 2K and stuff like that, you're buying randomized digital card packs that give your guys stats, boosts, or perks, or unlocks, or new characters for your, you know, create a Madden team. Or in Mass Effect 3, you know, you'd buy a weapons pack and you might get a good weapon or you might get a crappy weapon. But they're definitely integrating that randomized, you know, you pay for a random whatever thing into video games. And I feel like they've obviously been making money with it because they keep doing it, but there's also fan pushback. Whereas I feel like in card-based,
you know what the difference
games,
is, Christian? The difference is that when you buy it as a card, you own it. It's a thing you have and you can resell it. So the idea of randomization and rarity is an actual thing. So there's an element of the first C in CCG is collectible, and there's nothing collectible about digital content because it's infinite. So, I mean, there's a sense of that in what they're trying to do with Hearthstone and what Steam is doing with the sort of trading card stuff, and virtual trading cards are working that way. But then that's sort of built into the structure of those games and built into the pricing systems. They're not $60 games within this, you know, other thing.
Right. That's exactly right. And there is backlash. Don't get me wrong. There are people, when this comes out, there's going to be a lot of people who scream about it. And normally I would be upset. I mean, I don't want to be upset. I tend to like things that you can see what you're getting. But in this instance, I would be happy with every pack I bought because it gives me more dice and more stuff. And then you can trade it. There will be a secondary market, of course, with all that going on. But I think that most people – you get a lot in a starter deck. And I am sitting here with a lot of the stuff, okay? Magic, like I said. And I don't feel like some of it seems better than the rest of it. I'm just glad that I have a lot of diversity to play with, and I think these expansion packs will provide that. This is how WizKids has been doing it for years with their HeroClix setups, and people seem to be buying those. They're basically printing money at this point. And I'm already calling that this will be a hit and one of the biggest hits of 2014, period. I really believe that. I think this is going to hit a lot of people's sweet spot, and the price point is going to just do so well for them.
Is this that landmark game that you were predicting for this year? You said it was we were due for a landmark game in
2014. Yeah, no, this is not that game. I don't know anything. I'm not using any insider information. I'm just going by numbers. It just seems like we're due for some game that changes gaming landscape, like a Magic the Gathering or a Dominion or Settlers of Catan. So I know nothing. We'll know it when it shows up. But this, well, I don't think this is that.
I really like Couriers a lot and have played it numerous times at different friend's house, but I never bought it myself because I always felt like, okay, here's this new thing, this dice building game. I think somebody is going to do it in a way that's more interesting and take this mechanic and put it in a context that's not sort of silly, putting a Q in front of every sentence kind of aesthetic. And, you know, it looked like the Lord of the Rings might be that, and then that kind of didn't really work very well. And so this sounds like crack for me. I am really worried about how much money I may dump into this. What's the name of it again?
It's Dice Masters is the basic thing. This one is Marvel Dice Masters. But it's going to be Dice Masters. Yeah, I'll tell you what, though. The reason I wondered why more people didn't copy the Couriers thing, and that's because custom dice are incredibly expensive to do, and WizKids has managed to figure out some way to do it for a more inexpensive thing, and they're not sharing that information.
But they don't look low quality, huh? They still seem to be solid, and
they're not like ChessX quality, which is really high quality dice, but mm-hmm. I think they're fine. They look great. They use a symbol for like some of the characters. The symbol's easy. Spider-Man is a spider, and Punisher is a skull. Thor is a lightning bolt. Other ones, you look at it and you're like, okay, I guess that makes sense. Like, here's an R. I don't even know who the R is for. It's not Robin because he's not in this. It's Rogue. But I would not have guessed that.
Right.
But what symbol would they have used for her?
At a certain point,
of white hair.
Exactly. Yeah. A finger that'll touch you in the face. I don't know. It sounds awesome. So the idea is that you still have to are you building the deck before, or your dice equivalent of a deck beforehand, or you still have to purchase like you would in Couriers?
You have to purchase, but you get to pick the dice that you can purchase. So I bring a pool of dice for only me to purchase, and my opponent brings a pool of dice that only he can purchase. And then we each bring six special dice, basically. I don't know how to also describe them. They're like special effects, like they might be invulnerability or take cover or throw a car. And there will be four cards total. I bring two, you bring two. And both players can buy from those.
Man, that sounds awesome. I had no idea. This game wasn't even on my radar at all. And now I'm itching to play it.
Yeah, I played it at Board Game Geek Con this in November. And I usually play a game and move on. And I played this one, I think, five times in a row. And I'm, like I said, I'm really pumped about playing it very soon.
Wow. Well, another game that I played just this week for the first time is a relatively new game, a Japanese-developed game called Trains, and it's being released by AEG. I think it came out last year, or actually 2 years ago now, the 2012. And this is another one of those kind of mashup of different game mechanics. It's a deck-building game like Dominion. In fact, it feels a lot like Dominion. But then it also adds a board, and you're building train routes like you would in something like Ticket to Ride through Japan and on a hexagonal board. And so you're building your deck and spending money to add things to your deck like you would in Dominion, and using cards that allow you to now build train stations and train routes on this board. So it's not just a pure points grab of adding points into your hand, although those cards also exist, but it sort of mashes up this idea of building your deck and also playing something on a board. I found it to be pretty fun. I'm assuming you've played it too, right, Tom?
Yes. You said it came out in 2012. That's technically correct, but there was like very few copies. It was just the Japanese version. It was released from the company AEG in 2013, this past summer. And you're actually being nice calling it a mashup. It's just Dominion with a board.
Yeah.
That's the best way to say it because it's really the truth of it.
Yeah, I mean, it really feels like Dominion. I think the art is really pretty and the game is high quality and I had a good time, but I wasn't so certain that adding the board really added that much to the game.
I disagree a bit there. I really thought the board changed up the game. I like Dominion, but I like this better because I thought it added one more dimension. Dominion can sometimes be very linear. You're trying to make card combos. Here you're trying to make card combos and keep an eye on the board, and I thought it made it just a little bit more fun.
I just wanted a little bit. I guess I wanted a little more ticket to ride in my game, in the sense that there's no way to sort of block people or do anything that's particularly nasty to anybody, because everybody can sort of coexist on stuff. I mean, you can steal other people's points by building into their, if they've built up a train station on a certain tile, you can link your train into their station and then steal the points that they've just earned, or not really steal them, but share in them, get them as well. But there isn't really anything that lets me go, well, I took this route, so you can't.
So you want to be mean?
Well, I thought you liked mean. I thought you were about that.
Well, I do like mean many of the times. I find in deck builders like Dominion, I like them maybe not so mean, because it's fun to kind of put your own thing together and not as much fun when someone messes with you.
Right. No, it's a great game, and it was really fun. And I happened to win when we played, so I liked it a lot. But it's not something that I think I'm going to rush out and buy, just because it's like, well, you know, I got Dominion's fine, and it has, you know, 37 expansions, so you know, this game doesn't.
Yeah. What are your guys' thoughts on that? You know, the Me Too designer game design, where Dominion is, you know, wildly popular, and then all the Dominion lights or Dominion clones. I mean, does that bother you guys as you know, game players, or is it cool to see how people iterate on it? Like, oh, this adds a board. That's cool. I want to try it out because I'm such a huge Dominion fan. Are you waiting for, you know, the newest, latest, and best?
I'm a big fan of it, and I'll tell you why. Now, I don't want people to wholesale steal stuff, but I think when someone has a groundbreaking idea, and I mentioned some of that earlier, like Magic the Gathering was a groundbreaking idea, why not take it and try to improve upon it? Now, occasionally you can't. Magic the Gathering is a good example of that. There's been a lot of collectible card games, and while there, you know, there'll be arguments over which one's the best, it's still the king. But to take an idea like Dominion, and it's basically just introducing a way to play a game, it'd be kind of like the first board game. Someone put pieces on a board. So other people do board games. You're like, oh, you're stealing that idea. Well, I guess, but let's see what else we can do with that idea. So I think it's great when other people take these ideas and run with them. I mean, as long as you're not copying directly and as long as you give some sort of credence. I mean, like, if we had not allowed any other first-person shooters after Wolfenstein 3D, you know, would we still be playing Wolfenstein? That'd be kind of – well, it'd be fun actually, but
– if Hitler still need to be killed, then yes, we'd still be playing Wolfenstein.
Tom, have you played Hearthstone yet?
Is this a board game?
No, it's a video game, but it's from Blizzard, the guys that do World of Warcraft, and it is in my opinion a perfect refinement of Magic the Gathering. It takes Magic the Gathering. It's a trading card game. It's basically a digital version of a trading card game, but they made some really beautiful, elegant refinements to Magic the Gathering. I mean, it's a straight up lift of that style, but instead of having to manage your mana in your hand as cards, you have a digital mana pool that accelerates during each round on a really direct line. So it's not, there's never a case where you're like, well, I don't have any mana to play because it's not in my hand. You're getting an additional mana point every single round, which makes the progression to the bigger cards more direct and more even for both players, which I really like. And they're able to do things in the digital space because it's digital that are really interesting and different because they're not tied to physical cards. It can, you know, make multiples of things and do all kinds of crazy stuff that Magic has a harder time with because you have to physically, you know, add chits to your card or whatever. Anyway, It's fantastic, and I highly recommend you giving it a shot. It's an open beta. It's a free-to-play game, so you can play it for free. You can check it out. I think you would dig it, and I love it. I think it's very addictive.
I'll look it up. I see it here on the internet. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's the first game that I think takes Magic the Gathering and one-ups it, because I'm a huge Magic fan as well, and I find myself... As much as I love the sort of iPad version of Magic and Duels of Planeswalkers, I'm playing Hearthstone much more than I ever even played that, which was a lot. But there's something else I wanted to bring up with you, because this is a sort of a personal thing that I've been thinking about a lot. And I wonder if it resonates with you. I'm somebody that was big into comic books as a kid and collected them and lived through the sort of boom and bust of the 90s when comic books became... a huge mainstream, the idea of comic books was on everybody's lips. They made tons of money. Everybody was making them. And then all of a sudden there was this fallout and this crash and the, you know, Marvel almost went bankrupt and there was all this sort of negativity. Video games are the same way. You know, I think you and I are actually the same age. I'm old enough to remember, when video games weren't cool, when it was, you talked about video games on the playground and the cool kids didn't want to hang out with you. And for me, I always wanted video games to be this mainstream thing. And then all of a sudden they were, and I'm not so certain it turned out to be a good thing. There's this idea that once it hits mainstream, there's an acceptance and a proliferation of the hobby into more people's lives, and then it's going to be great for everybody. But I think there's also this dark side where when it becomes mainstream, you get a whole lot of people involved that kind of bring it down, and there's a darkness to the whole thing. And we see a lot of that on the internet with some video game fans acting in really inappropriate ways. And I wonder how you feel about board games, because I love board games and have done for years now, but part of what I love about the culture of board games is that it's still small and that it's still a little underground and that there's a real genuine love and sort of wholesomeness about it. And I know that you are sort of on the forefront of getting board games, and I hope I am as well. I'm trying to open up the audience for board games and get people more interested and have people realize that they're really fun and really exciting and there's a lot of energy there. But we're seeing so many games flood the market and such an expansion of the hobby. I wonder if you think that that is only a good thing or if you think that that might be a bad thing as well.
So you're basically asking me if when I liked the band and no one else did, it was cool. But now that my music's gone mainstream.
I'm embarrassed to say that's kind of what I'm saying, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It comes across when people make this argument – it comes across almost as, and I'm not saying you're this way, unless you want to take it that way, that it comes across as selfish, you know, because like, I like this and I don't mind having a few other people, but if everyone starts doing it, come on. And there are bad elements of human society for sure. And I think it's fair to say there's a lot of them in video gaming and there's a lot of them in gaming in general. You go to a game convention, you can find these folks there. But at the same time, I don't really care that much. If it went mainstream, I would be pleased as punch, because even if something goes mainstream and you're like, oh, well, there's not so much innovative stuff, there's always going to be a subculture within the mainstream doing something new and interesting. Like with video games, there's a lot of cool indie game designers out there now that are doing some really cool stuff that the big publishers aren't doing, you know. And they even have their own awards and things like that. I think with board games that might happen. The more it goes mainstream, the cheaper it gets, the more people I can talk to about it. I think it's a positive thing. So I don't know why I wouldn't want it to go mainstream, why I wouldn't want more people to do it if it's a positive thing.
I think the fear of it going mainstream is that while like there still might be cool hip stuff on the fringe, like the indie scene that you can check out, is that, you know, the publishers or the market or, you know, the designers going after that mainstream and focusing on that mainstream and the thing that you used to love about it and being the thing that people would talk about it at conventions and would be heralded and held up does become marginalized. And something like you, there are more people you can talk about. You can talk about the hobby with, but at the same time, I think to some extent with video games and even comic books, it's become annoying where, and yeah, it's a little hipsterish, like I want this because I like it and it's cool when I like it. But it used to be I could see someone with an X-Men shirt on, right, and know that we have a kinship and we can talk. Now it's like, oh, I got it at Urban Outfitters. I don't know. It's cool. I liked the movie. Or, you know, your family, you're at like a big family get together. It's Christmas or a barbecue or whatever. And someone's like, oh, yeah, I heard you like video games, Christian. Let's talk about, you know, Call of Duty for 5 hours. And it's like, I have no interest in having that conversation, but I don't want to be rude to cousin Tim that's trying to engage my interests or whatever. And it's just like, that's not what I'm interested in. Let's talk about Mark of the Ninja. And they're just like, what is that? And it creates this weird disconnect where people, I think they know you. And because that's the mainstream thing, but that's not what you're into. And it becomes frustrating as a fan of that thing to have your thing be diluted with what you consider oftentimes to be crap. And for me, that's what's frustrating about things becoming mainstream.
Well, I can understand that point of view. It just, I guess that doesn't bother me as much. I'm glad that I don't have to, that I'm not made as much fun of for being a geek these days. I didn't enjoy that part of being a kid. I didn't enjoy everyone making fun of me because I like comic books and video games. It's nice that people all like video games now. I mean, every kid that I know plays video games.
Yeah.
I got being a nerd is kind of cool. I got kids in my youth group who wear glasses. They don't even have to. I wish my bad eyesight would go away when I was a kid because I got called four eyes and nerd. Now kids are wearing glass with no glass in them. It's so weird.
It's a bizarro world that we're living in now. I mean, is there anything, any, and I appreciate that. And I applaud the positivity. I'm just wondering, is there any concern to the sort of comic book example of it collapsing under the weight of itself? You know, there's so many board games that come out.
But I mean, at the same time, I've yet to see many industries other than technology, of course, that just completely disappear. Like you said, the comic book industry collapsed upon itself, but I am having the most fun reading comic books today than I ever had because they went onto the iPad. Mm. And that is such a tremendous way I can carry my entire comic book collection around with me wherever I go. And that has made comic book reading that much more enjoyable to me. And so, yeah, sure, board games may collapse in the future. Who knows? Whatever. I don't know. That'd be bad for me, I guess. But at the same time, I don't think it will just completely collapse. I think it might just get a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
I have a quick question for Tom. Or Jeff, too. I haven't actually asked you this. Have either of you played Innominy? It's a Steve Jackson Games game.
What's it called?
Innominy? Innominé?
Do you spell it?
I-N space N-O-M-I-N-E. It's mid or late 90s.
It's a role-playing game.
Yes. It's kind of like Werewolf or Vampire the Masquerade is how I would describe it.
No, I haven't played it because I'm looking at it on the internet right now, and it looks like a game that cost about $2 for them to have made. And it's a role-playing game, so I only played a few role-playing games since they take up so much time.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, do you think that there's still room then in today's designer game area for like the pen and paper role-playing game, or are they kind of being...
Oh, yeah, there is. I mean, there's huge markets for that. Pathfinder from Paizo, Dungeons & Dragons about to release a new edition. There's Numenera just came up. There's a lot of those. I personally don't play those as much because I have to watch what I do with my time. And, you know, earlier you guys talked about me playing so many board games. One of the reasons is I don't play as much role-playing games.
Can I ask about – I've always been curious about this as a fan of your stuff. Can you explain mechanically as a person who has all these other interests in your life as well and a family and all that stuff, just purely mechanically, like how you fit it all in? Do you have –
we all have the same amount of time.
Right. Yeah. So I would love to play 10 times as many board games as I play now. I mean, do you have multiple groups on multiple nights, or how does it all work?
Well, I sleep about 6 hours a night, maybe at the most. So that's part of it. I don't watch a ton of movies and TV. I watch some. And when I do watch it, I'm often doing something else at the same time. When I play games, I just get down to it. Let's play. And then I sit around and talk. I don't know.
But it's a hobby that requires other people to be involved. So you sort of have a – here's what I imagine about your life, Tom. I imagine you have this open door policy at your home where people just are constantly coming in to play games with you. Is that accurate?
Well, or am kind I of, crazy? Sort of, but it can't be open policy because there would be some guys who would be at my house every day. I have a gaming group thing I do twice a week, and then I play all day every other week usually, and then I also play games with my family occasionally. I get them done. I don't know how to explain it. I just kind of try not to waste as much time as I can.
Well, I think it's just an envious thing. I'm listening to you and going, oh man, I wish I had more people in my life that would just come over and play games with me.
Well, and Tom's listening to us and thinking, oh man, I could be playing so many games right now instead of doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you probably do have people you can play games with. If you're near any kind of metropolis area, it is very easy using things like Meetup, Facebook, Board Game Geek to find people who play games. There's Indeed. Probably folks that play games somewhere in your area.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. And we've talked about that before on the show as well. And I heartily agree. I feel like you are known for that. So people kind of gravitate to you and it must be nice. So I just want to put that out into the world. Let's take another call before we wrap things up on this episode. We have a call from 617. Do you have a question about board gaming for Tom? Hi.
Yeah, kind of thinking about longer term trends in board games. You know, we had this era where there was the Avalon Hill super hardcore games, and then the kind of mainstream American games, and things kind of came together with the German games coming over from Europe, you know, the settlers and whatnot. Where do you see those kind of, it seems to be kind of fracturing into all these different subgenres, and you've got games that are just spin-offs of Dominion. Where do you see that kind of stuff going, and what does it mean for us as players?
We're always going to see the next big thing coming. Magic the Gathering was arguably that, and Dungeons and Dragons were probably the two biggest game changers in the board gaming world. I've made the half tongue in cheek call that I expect to see one of those this year. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. And when we do, you can expect that half the industry will follow that and move on. The biggest game changer right now is a mix between the internet in general, because of the way people can find out about a game and buy it and have it sent to their house, you know, instantly, and to a smaller extent, being more specific, Kickstarter has certainly changed the board gaming industry. There are hundreds and hundreds of new games coming out each year now that would probably not have come out otherwise. Several of them are good. A majority of them are mediocre, and some of them are horrifically bad and should be burned. But it certainly is changing the industry. How do we react to that? I don't know. Keep listening to reviewers. That's always my advice.
There you go. And you can listen to Tom reviewing games by listening. First of all, I highly recommend listening to the Dice Tower audio show, which you can get at dicetower.com. Also, he has a really fantastic YouTube channel that is constantly updating with Dice Tower news. You've got a board gaming breakfast show now that tells you about the news of the week. Tell us more about what we can expect from you and how we can find you.
You can find all our stuff at dicetower.com. Like you said, we have a videos YouTube channel in which we do reviews, top 10 lists, board game breakfast each week. We do previews sometimes of games that are on Kickstarter. And then the rest of it you can find. We do audio shows. I'm always trying to do something new and unusual, so you never know what show might show up next. I do a couple shows. Like I do a show called Board Game University where I interview people in the hobby, or Dice Tower Showdown where people argue over things that aren't important, but you know, we like to listen to it anyway. And I would be remiss if I also did not mention something that's not associated with the Dice Tower, but I also run a charity called the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund, which is at jackvassell.org, which is a charity to help gamers in their time of need.
Yeah, which is fantastic and does a lot of really wonderful work for a lot of really great people, and is a testament to you and the stuff that you do, that that's part of what you're about, which is great. This has been an absolute treat for me to have you on, Tom. I honestly have been a big fan of yours for a long time, and love the sort of positivity you put out into the world, and really dig the show. Christian, I also like you, which has been established now. I like you. We're buds. I think Tom knows a little something about people thinking that co-hosts hate each other, but
I'll tell you, once you I've done a lot of these fake feuds in the past, and I'll tell you, every time I could take a picture of me shaking the person's hand and hugging them and jumping in front of a train for them, but it's too late. People are already convinced you're mortal enemies.
What's going on with you this week, Christian?
February is a fun month for me. February 11th is my next What's New live show at Nerdmelt here in Los Angeles. And it's also will be released as a podcast on the Nerdist Network. It's called What's New with Christian Spicer. It's February 11th at 9 p.m. February 13th, Improv versus Stand-Up is at UCB LA. And then I take a red-eye flight right after that show and fly to North Carolina for the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival. It's a great comedy fest, been there several years, and I'll be doing a set out there and also bringing Improv versus Stand-Up out there. So I'm excited for that. If you're in the area, you know, come say hi, we'll hang out. It'll be tons of fun. And then, Jeff, you have your play, and then you're also a celebrity guest in an upcoming show. Is that, do I have that correct?
You have that correct. Yeah, we're doing a really cool comedy show in LA called Broadly Speaking. It's gonna be a fundraiser as well for women's issues and really cool charities. They do a rotating group of charities. So I'm gonna be on the show as the celebrity guest, and I will be participating in a game that is rigged, that I am going to wager my own money and be guaranteed to lose it. And that money will be then donated to charity, which is really, really cool. But it's a live show, and it's going to be really funny. It's not just a cause. It's also a really fun show with a bunch of great female comedians that will be doing stand-up and heckling me and my ridiculous-looking mustache right now. But I'm also doing a play. I really appreciated all the Weekend Confirmed and DLC listeners that went to the show these last couple of weeks. We have one more weekend in Palos Verdes, and then we move to Palm Springs. So you can find out all the information about that. It's called The 39 Steps. It's on my website, jeffcanada.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T. This week at Mulachi said that DLC stands for Dubious Life Choices, which is certainly true. We appreciate you listening. Again, thanks, Tom, for being here. I wish you the best of luck with your new baby that's coming very soon. And congratulations on your very successful Kickstarter that just ended as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for being with us. And thank you for listening. Until next week, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.